insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey there. Good morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. And the number to call to be on the air is 888-914-9149. You can call that number now. We do have a few lines open. That will change soon, though. 888-914-9149. Emails go to patrick@relevantradio.com. I have one right here. This is from Amanda. Came in overnight. She says, Patrick, I enjoyed your tips about talking about the birds and the bees with kids. That was yesterday's program. My oldest son is 5, so my husband won't have that full talk with him for a long time. We live on a hobby farm, which provides opportunities for kids to learn about procreation in animals. They see baby kittens, they see chickens laying eggs, et cetera, et cetera. We have talked about how animals need both a male and a female to produce babies and the general differences between male and female animals. It's a nice natural way, she says, for kids to start learning about these topics in age-appropriate ways. Very true. Very true. That topic did garner quite a bit of attention and response by way of email. If you missed it and you're interested, I was asked by, it was the wife asking maybe on behalf of her husband, what do you recommend for the birds and the bees talk? And so if you missed that, I gave my explanation of what I would recommend. I didn't get into things that I wouldn't recommend. I figured that was superfluous. But if you'd like to hear that, you'll find it on the Relevant Radio app. Just go to yesterday's program. I think it was second hour. And you can also go to relevantradio.com for that. Let's go to Astoria, New York, and talk to E. Frank. Hello, E. Frank. Welcome. Hello, E. Frank. You are on the air. E. Frank is not ready to go on the air. Okay. Well, E. Frank is not ready to go on the air. We'll see if he gets ready at some point. So we'll go next to Chicago and talk to Deacon Dave. Hello, Deacon Dave.
Hey, Patrick.
Hi there.
How convenient for me is that the other guy wasn't ready.
He wasn't ready, so you were the second, third, fourth in line, something like that, but you're up right now.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question for you. I was listening to the Patrick Madrid show, the Drew Mariani show yesterday, and I don't remember if it was yesterday's show or the previous day's show, but they were talking about the ability or what angels would envy about the human being, and one was to receive the Eucharist, and the other one was the ability to suffer because of the value in suffering. But it confused me a little bit because I think about Satan, and he must be suffering in hell.
Yes,
and so it doesn't make any sense they can't suffer.
Well, there you go. And I was going to wait until you were done asking the question because I think that premise is faulty. We can't say with certitude that angels, so the good angels who pass their test, I think we could reason our way toward the fact that they cannot suffer because they're confirmed in grace, just as the saints in heaven cannot suffer because they're confirmed in grace.
Yes.
It's a hard concept for us to understand, but I think we can assert that because we know they see God face to face and they're perfected in righteousness. So no suffering for them. But we can't argue, I don't think, that solely on the nature of angels that they couldn't suffer, because that leads to your point, which is, well, what about all the demons? They clearly are suffering. And one thing I find interesting, Deacon Dave, is that when the Lord speaks about, let's say, to use an example, in Matthew 25, where he speaks about the sheep and the goats, and I know you know this, you preached on this before, but for those listening, on the day of judgment, and the Lord separates all the souls into two categories, the sheep on the right hand and the goats on the left hand. The sheep are the ones, he says, when I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me to drink, etc. Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty? Well, because you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me. And then he turns to the goats and he says the same thing, but in reverse, because they didn't help feed the hungry, clothe the naked, etc. And then when he finishes with the goats, he says to go off into that everlasting fire prepared for this is the everlasting fire that is prepared for those who don't love God. And what's interesting is if you do a kind of a word search, or you just look at every time this issue comes up in Scripture, you see that he sometimes refers to the devil, and he does so here in Matthew 25. This is in verse 41. "Depart from me, you accursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." So I think that's the glimpse of the answer here, is that, of course, angels can suffer, and here we mean by angels, fallen angels, because what point would this have? I mean, it would be superfluous. It would be irrelevant if God is, if Jesus here is saying that the cursed human beings are going to go to the place where the devil and his angels are experiencing eternal fire. If that doesn't cause them suffering, then what's the point of that? There really is no point. So that's why, going back to the way you were asking the question, or at least the way you were telling me how the other people were saying it, I think that's their flaw, is that they're operating from a false assumption, which is that angels can't suffer. What do you think?
Great, man. That makes a lot of sense. I was thinking maybe there was a possibility in their understanding that before their fall, that they couldn't suffer.
Well, that too is interesting, and we could speculate. We don't have direct divine revelation to tell us this. Maybe we can reason our way toward that by way of analogy with Adam and Eve. So Adam and Eve were in a similar kind of state, although they were in time and space. Angels, as you know, are not. And so Adam and Eve didn't suffer before the fall. They sure did after the fall. But they didn't suffer before the fall. Now, if we can reason our way toward how it would have been for the angels, I think we could say the same thing. But for the angels, we're told, it was an instantaneous thing. So St. Thomas, for example, in his treatise on the angels, in the Summa Theologiae anyway, he says that all the evidence indicates that when an angel is created, or all the angels were created, that they immediately possessed the fullness, the definitive fullness of everything they could know. And their knowledge is vast, obviously not as vast as God's, but far vaster than our own knowledge, and that angels don't have to reason their way toward conclusions. They know them with certitude. They have this infused knowledge, and their knowledge is vast. So their test was immediate, because they didn't have to like grow up from baby angels to become big enough to say, oh wow, we're angels, that's cool, like we do as human beings. They came online, so to speak, fully aware, with complete knowledge, and they were given a choice. Okay, are you going to love God and see God as the source of your beauty and power, or are you going to turn inward and look to yourself as the source of your beauty and power? That's what we think the nature of their fall was, having to do with pride. It couldn't have been a physical temptation, like a sexual temptation or food or anything like that, because they're incorporeal. So if this was their temptation, those who fell immediately. Those who passed immediately. And then the good angels went directly into the beatific vision. So they didn't see God before that face to face the way they see him now in heaven. And mm-hmm. The fallen angels never saw God face to face. That's part of their suffering, is that they're utterly mm-hmm. forever stranded apart from the God who created them to be beautiful and powerful, and they forfeited that. Isn't that a horrible thing to imagine?
My goodness gracious.
I know.
So to sort of sum that up, you could say that the simple fact that you've never experienced suffering doesn't mean that you can't experience suffering.
I think so, yeah. I mean, that's true. Now, we're talking about angels here, right? Because human beings suffer in many different ways.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think that we could say that
Adam and Eve was the same.
Repeat that for me, please.
Didn't experience suffering. Well, you said the same about Adam and Eve, that before their fall, they didn't experience suffering, but that didn't mean that they couldn't.
Well, that's an open question. I mean, could they have suffered before the fall? I don't know. I think not. And I think it was due to their circumstances, not their nature. I don't think that the human nature, I mean, obviously we know from experience that human nature is susceptible to suffering, but their circumstances were so idyllic that it seems they were preserved from suffering for that period of time. But what I guess what I'm saying here is that angels, I don't think we could say that just because they're angels, they can't suffer. And exhibit A is the demons. They certainly suffer.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thank you, Deacon Dave.
You are such a gift to the church.
Well, it's kind of you to say so. I hope God feels that way, but I appreciate your prayers, that's for sure. And thanks for listening to the program. Yeah, thinking about angels for a minute, the nature of angels is so different from humans. I know it's a common thing for people to say, well, she's an angel now in heaven. No, I understand the concept. It's a comforting thought to think of somebody who's departed to become an angel. But we as human beings never cease to be human beings by nature. Our human nature will always be what it is. For those in heaven, we become, as Jesus says, like the angels in certain respects. For example, there's no marriage or giving in marriage, Jesus says. So there won't be any procreation the way there is now. But we don't become angels. And the fundamental difference, before I go on to the next call here, and this is worth thinking about if you really want to ponder angels, is that the fundamental difference, or a fundamental difference, perhaps there are others, but one particular one that I think about is that you as a human being are made body and soul as a composite. So your body needs your soul. And as you know, when the soul departs from the body, that's when death takes place. And the body is done. The body can't do anything without the soul. If the soul leaves the body, that's it. Kaput. No mas. And the soul also needs the body. So when you think about, let's say, somebody who's on in years and develops a form of dementia, and doesn't mean that the soul has dementia. The soul is incorporeal. The soul is indivisible. You can't cut it in half. It's utterly simple. It's not composed of parts. Your soul is you, but it's pure spirit insofar as it's indivisible, etc. But it's made for a body. So when you think about the person who has dementia, ponder this. Does the soul have dementia, or is the soul's interaction with the body through the brain, through the cerebral cortex, through the nerve synapses, through all the different parts of the physical body that you have in your brain and associated areas of your body? If the soul cannot properly function through those bodily parts, that's when things like blindness or deafness or dementia or other disabilities like that come in. It's not a disability in your soul. It's a disability in your body, and your body can't respond to the soul the way it previously could. So your memory, for example, it's not that your soul loses its memory. It's that the body can no longer process in the same way the memory component of this interaction between your body and soul. It's fascinating when you think about it. And ultimately, when as Frank Sheed puts it so well, when the body, due to damage or some other reason, can no longer respond to those life-giving energies of the soul, then they separate and the body stops functioning and it begins to decompose. The soul continues on. And you might say, well, how can that be? I mean, if the soul needs the body, how can the soul continue on permanently? Well, here again, we look to St. Thomas for advice and guidance here. And he points out kind of a blindingly obvious truth, and that is that your soul can do things that don't require your body. The soul can know and love. The soul can make decisions. The soul can be aware of itself. The soul can be aware of God. And although we grow up using our body to have these thoughts and things of that nature, the soul doesn't require a body to do those things. Therefore, your soul is eternal, because it doesn't matter if the body and soul separate, the soul will continue on for all eternity. Fascinating stuff, if you ask me. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to E. Frank. We'll see if he's ready to go on the air. Good morning, E. Frank, in Astoria, New York.
Yes, good morning, Patrick. I truly apologize.
Oh, don't worry. Happens all the time.
It's just that the great-great-great-great-niece of Laura Ingalls Wilder and four of her friends were outside my apartment building, and they were...
...it on time, so let's get right to it.
All right, so what I wanted to discuss with you, Patrick, is in regards to church ceremonies that fall under the canonical laws of the church itself. For example, on Holy Thursday, I objected to the individuals who were there on the washing of the feet. And I said, you know, maybe certain people like the youth worker or the other, the Crucijo movement, the individuals who were chosen for Holy Thursday, mass to do the washing of the feet. I told my pastor, who is a prefect of the Catholic Church, that perhaps under canonical laws, he should have chosen other people to allow the church to proceed under continuum of church history.
Do me a favor. Do me a favor, because I'm getting lost here. Just give me the cash value. What specifically are you wondering about?
Is it correct to complain under canonical law about the ceremonies that are incurred in the church when you don't like the way the pastor is conducting the ceremony? Can you complain about an issue of that nature?
Can you or should you? Can you? Yeah, you can. Should you? Probably not. I mean, unless there's something egregious, let's say that, and this is insane, and I'm hopeful that it would never even enter the mind of anybody to do it, but let's say that the priest said, okay, this Holy Thursday, instead of washing the feet of human beings, we're going to get a bunch of dogs up here and wash their paws. I mean, ridiculous. It's not even within anyone's experience. If that happened, sure, I would complain. I write a letter to the bishop. Yeah, there are times when it's appropriate. But if the priest is choosing a group of people not to your liking, I would say deal with it. You know, it's not really appropriate to complain about something like that. If you were the pastor of a parish and you chose X group of people to do the washing of the feet, and there was nothing, you know, materially problematic about that, just that the guy in the pew doesn't like them, I mean, you have that right as the priest to do that. Is that what you're referring to? You just didn't like the people that he chose?
Yeah, because they didn't fall under the church calendar that I live under. I live under the day when the priest wears his vestments on ordinary days. On
So you're following the liturgical calendar of as it was before Vatican II. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So if you want to follow that calendar, go to a Catholic parish where the traditional rite is permitted. If you want to attend or you are attending a parish where the rite as it stands after Vatican II is in force, then follow that. I don't see any point in following the other calendar if you're going to be in a parish where the new rite is celebrated, any more than I would see why you would follow the new calendar if you were in a parish where the old rite was celebrated. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right, Patrick. I understand the reasoning, but I feel that's anti-Catholic and un-Christian, like when a pastor decides to go according to what he believes the liturgy should be conducted. My pastor says...
Wait a minute. You're saying he's anti-Catholic for doing that? And you're saying that you have the right to make that decision, not him? So if he's anti-Catholic for doing what he thinks is right, aren't you anti-Catholic for doing what you think is right?
Well, I was always suggesting... I alternated between an archdiocesan pastor and a diocesan... Well, a prefect of the Catholic Church, and I always would give them...
I don't even know what that means. That's not a title. You could be a prefect of a dicastery in the Vatican, for example, or the prefect of a religious house of studies or something. But in the parish, I mean, you're a pastor or an administrator or, an associate pastor. I guess I would put it this way, Efrank. I do have to take a break. The thing is, if you object to how the pastor is running the show, go to a different parish. And if you want to adhere to the traditional calendar, great. Go to a parish where that's what they adhere to. Problem solved. God bless you, sir. I hope you have a wonderful day today. I'll be right back. Today, we'd like to thank Rosario, who is listening in New Mexico, for donating her 2014 Fiat 500. Classy. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, the best email of the day so far anyway. This might be a hard one to beat. This is from... Well, she says anonymous, but I'm just going to say your name, okay? I mean, because no one's going to track you down. Elizabeth, listening somewhere in the Midwest. We'll just leave it at that. And she's writing in about E. Frank's call from a moment ago. I want to know, she says, what the great, great, great nieces of Laura Ingalls Wilder were doing outside of his apartment building, Patrick. And I'm probably not the only one. I think you're right. I shared the same curiosity. She says they sounded a little rowdy, though. Well, that part, if they were loud enough to deter him from being able to hang on to be on the air, I mean, that's just an interesting, it sounds like a Seinfeld episode in a way. You know, one of the characters is online to talk to a radio show. And who's that out there? Oh, that's the great, great, great niece of Laura Ingalls Wilder. How would you know that? I don't know, but that is interesting. And I share your curiosity. I think we'll never know the answer to that question, though, Elizabeth. Thanks for taking a moment to write to me. You got a gold star for the most interesting, funny email of the day so far. Let's go to a different Elizabeth now. Elizabeth in Minnesota. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, thanks
You're on
for
the
taking
air.
My call.
You're welcome.
I just had a question about euthanasia. I want to know what exactly the church teaches about it and, like, when, if ever, it's okay to withhold life support.
So by euthanasia, you're referring to assisted suicide, somebody ending his own life? Okay. Well, the church says that it is always a grave sin to intentionally end the life of an innocent person. So whether that's through some form of murder or some other variation on that theme, up to and including putting the person to death by medicine or for some other way, that's morally reprehensible and is always a sin. So euthanasia as such is a serious sin that we should always avoid. We should always oppose it because it's intentionally taking the life of an innocent person. So that's the simple answer. Maybe there's more to your question than that, though.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, my grandpa was talking about, like, if someone's dying of, like, a heart attack, and they're going to die anyway, is it okay to, like, at any point to stop, like, artificial, like, pumping of their heart?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they're going to die from that.
Right. That is a nuance that is not directly euthanasia. So let's talk about that. If somebody is in a coma, let's say, and can't eat for himself, can't do anything for himself, he needs assistance because he's in a coma to stay alive. If it's just normal, everyday, what the church would call ordinary assistance, like feeding the person, giving him water, and even if maybe he can't swallow because he's in a coma, let's say, there could be a tube put in to provide nourishment, to provide hydration. That's all normal. And if the person can receive it and the body doesn't reject it, then we do have an obligation to continue to do that. So it would be wrong if somebody said, well, this is taking forever. When is this guy going to die? Let's just stop feeding him. He's in a coma. He won't even know. That would be murder if you starved somebody to death like that or withheld hydration. And we're talking about normal situations where his body can easily handle food and water. It'd be like saying, well, let's just, you know, suck all the air out of the room so he'll suffocate. No, you can't do that. He needs to breathe. Now, he's not aware of breathing. He's just like you and I aren't aware of breathing when we're asleep. It's our autonomic system that continues to breathe for us. We don't. So let's say a ventilator. if that was what was keeping this patient alive and there was no way for him to live if he weren't on that breathing machine, the ventilator, then in that case, the church looks at that as an extraordinary means of helping him stay alive. And this is where there's a difference. The church says that if it's determined that this person is not going to wake up, can't live without the ventilator, that if you decide to unplug the ventilator, turn it off, disconnect it, what have you, that that's not a sin. And it's certainly not euthanasia, because you are not intentionally letting the person die. You're not intentionally killing the person. You know that the likelihood is very high that he will die when you remove that extraordinary measure of the ventilator, but you're not causing his death. You're not intentionally causing his death. And this is where it gets into something called the principle of double effect. Have you ever heard of that phrase, Elizabeth?
Not really, no.
Well, write that down, or at least remember it, because it's an important nuance in the world of Catholic moral theology. And essentially what it means is there are some things that are not immoral in themselves that could have an unintended negative consequence. And this would be an example of that. So the principle of double effect is there are two effects here. One is that you are removing the extraordinary means of life support, knowing that the likelihood of the patient's death is very high, maybe even guaranteed, but you're not intending to cause his death. So the unintended double effect would be his death. I'll give you another example. You're 16, so I'm sure by now you understand the reproductive system and how it works, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So in female physiology, the fallopian tubes are the tubes from which the ova, the eggs, come from the ovary down to the uterus. You know all about that, so we don't have to go into detail. Sometimes there can happen what's called an ectopic pregnancy, where an egg that has been fertilized can lodge and get stuck in the fallopian tube. And that's a living human being because fertilization has taken place. Unusual circumstance. It's not common, but it does happen. So there's an example where in order to save the life of the woman, the only way to save her life is to surgically remove the fallopian tube. But you know that by doing this, the little tiny unborn human being can't survive because he or she is too young to survive outside of the mother. So when the doctors and the mother, for example, and her husband, when they make this decision, okay, we're going to go forward with the surgery, this is an example of the principle of double effect, because the intention of the act is to cure the woman's illness, which is the problem with the fallopian tube, so that she doesn't die, knowing that by removing the fallopian tube, the death of the child, which is not intended, they're not trying to kill this unborn baby, they're trying to save the life of the mother through removing the fallopian tube. That would be an example of where something like that would be morally permissible. It's not ideal, because the baby winds up dying, but you really have no choice. And the mother and the doctors are not trying to kill the child, they're trying to save the mother. Now, that would be different from an abortion, because in the case of an abortion, so now the baby, let's say, has implanted in the uterine wall, and the baby's not in danger of dying, and the mother's not in danger of dying. And even if the mother were in danger of dying, that's a separate discussion we could have. But the point here is that if then they decided, well, we are now going to perform a surgery to abort that child, that would be immoral, because it's an intentional, direct effort to end the life of that innocent person. In the case of the fallopian tube, it's an unintended negative side effect. Do you see? It's a very subtle distinction, but do you see that distinction?
Yeah, Okay. See that?
Have I given you too much of an answer? I didn't mean to. I just wanted to give you an answer that was understandable.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Let me recommend a book to you, because who knows, maybe one day you'll end up as a physician and you'll be making similar decisions down the road. So here's a good book. It's called Life Issues, Medical Choices. And it's a good book. It's got maybe 50 or so real world scenario questions, just like this. Is it moral to disconnect the ventilator from a patient who's in a coma? And so this and many other examples that probably have never even occurred to you, but they're all explained in this book in a way that you'll be able to see, okay, that's why this would be immoral. But that, like the removal of the fallopian tube, would not be immoral under the following circumstances. So if you'd like to go deeper, I think that book would be of great interest to you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, well, did we cover it?
Yep, that's perfect.
Okay, well, thank you for taking the time to walk through that with me. I appreciate that. Let's go to Ed now in Chicago. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Patrick. My question is about baptism. I was originally baptized through the Catholic Church as an infant, and I hope I'm saying this part right. When we were growing up, like the neighborhood kids were about 11, 12, used to have these, I guess, evangelicals type individuals telling, hey, why don't you guys come to church? We'll pick you kids up. And we did all of that. You know, a lot of the kids in the neighborhood went on the school bus and they drove us to the church. And I recall one moment where they had baptism. And, you know, through ignorance, you know, we just all went along with the program and, you know, we got baptized. Does that do anything to my original baptism through the Catholic Church? Or is there something that I need to do to, you know, say, okay, I through ignorance, I didn't know what we were doing as kids.
And how old were you when this took place, Ed? You were a kid? How old?
Probably about 11 or 12 years old, because they would come, you know, to the neighborhood. And then, you know, after a couple of times doing it, we're like, nah, I don't think we want to do this anymore.
I understand. I can picture it. So no, so you were not aware when you were 10, 11 years old that you were doing something that, for somebody who would be aware, like, you know I'm baptized in the Catholic Church. I know that rebaptism is impossible, but I'll do it anyway. That would be sinful for somebody who knew better. But as a kid, you didn't know better. So if your conscience is troubling you, and it's okay if it is, then just bring it up at confession the next time you go and just say, you know, this crazy thing when I was a kid, and tell the priest what you just told me, and I didn't understand it, I didn't know there was a problem with it, but now later in life that I know more, I realize that I shouldn't have done it, but I didn't know that I shouldn't do it. I did it innocently, and I just want to mention it, Father, because I don't even know if it's a sin, but I would just like to mention it so that I can leave this at the foot of the cross and it will never nag me again. You'll never have to worry about it again. You've left it at the foot of the cross, and Jesus has taken care of it. No, I don't believe you committed any kind of a sin.
Okay.
But let's talk for a minute about why doing that would be wrong in the abstract. Because there is, the Bible says, one faith, one Lord, one baptism. So there is not a Baptist baptism or a non-denominational baptism or a Lutheran baptism or a Calvinist baptism or any of those. There's only baptism, and baptism accomplishes what it symbolizes. Or as St. Peter says, baptism now saves you, because it's the regeneration, it's the rebirth that Jesus spoke about to Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Unless a man is born again or born from above by water and the Holy Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. So he's referring there very clearly to the sacrament of water baptism. And it's not, as St. Peter says, it's not the washing of dirt from the body, but it's an appeal to God for a clean conscience. So the symbolic action of pouring water over the head or immersing the person in the water is, it actually is a symbol of what it is actually doing to the soul, which is it eradicates all sin and all the effects of sin. It eradicates the state of original sin, the condition of original sin, and it regenerates the soul.
I know,
hear me out. Hear me out, though. This is important, Ed. I want you to be clear on what this does. So it regenerates your soul and infuses it with grace. The reason I'm kind of going step by step here is so you can realize when that happens, it can never be repeated. So it permanently, indelibly conforms you to Jesus. And it can never be repeated. It couldn't be repeated because it's already there. So no matter how many times a person might go through the action of being baptized or rebaptized or rebaptized, if he's already been validly baptized, all those things are just fluff. They don't mean anything.
Okay.
But that's an important part of the whole thing. I just want to make sure you were clear on that part. Anything more, Ed, you want to say?
No, that was it, because we were talking about that, and I was like, wait a minute, I remember when we were kids, and I don't know if you can picture, you know, these people coming to, you know, gather all these
kids. Of course I can. It's like a religious ice cream truck roaming around the neighborhoods looking for people. Yeah, I get it.
And then after we did, and I was like, did I do something wrong? So I figured, no, let me call the show and find out.
Well, do you feel like you understand more clearly now?
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay.
And then your explanation there at the end sealed it, so.
Awesome. Well, good. And if anyone else listening had the same experience and your conscience is nagging you, no problem. Just when you go to confession, mention it and then you're done with it. You never have to worry about it again. I'll be right back. Thanks to network sponsor PushPay. PushPay offers parishes a platform for tracking donations and sacraments, overseeing schedules, mobile apps to help manage your administrative load, and much more. Info at relevantradio.com/pushpay. That's relevantradio.com/pushpay.
Hello. Hello again. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Real life solutions you can believe in. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. That number is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters. What number you say? It's 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Here is a quick email I'd like to get to briefly. This is from Anonymous. Now, I know his name, but he asked me to keep anonymous, and I know where in the country he is, but I think it'd be better not to even mention that. Somewhere in the United States, Anonymous says, my wife works at a Jesuit high school that has gone full tilt anti-Catholic. They give lip service to the faith. They have hired at least 30% homosexual teachers. They promote transsexualism, transgenderism, and all other perversity. There was a student who was acting effeminate, and the school supported his desire to be a girl and instructed the teachers not to inform the parents. They are now promoting an LGBTQ, quote-unquote, Catholic group to train all the teachers in this ideology. This was an all-boys school, and parents who send their boys there are in danger of having them indoctrinated and worse. He says, please warn parents that the name Catholic has become meaningless in some schools, and it would be better for them to homeschool. How do we get the word out? Well, I think the word's already out there. And people are smart enough anyway. So let's just put it this way. Parents, if the Catholic school that you're shelling out a lot of money for the tuition for is not serving your son or daughter or sons and daughters fully and properly, then I agree with Anonymous's point, which is look for an alternative. Look for a different Catholic school if that's possible. Often it is. Sometimes it's not. But if your son or daughter or sons and daughters are attending schools where they're being overrun by destructive and anti-Jesus ideologies like that, then you have an obligation to do everything you can to shield your children from such things. And normally we talk about this in the context of public schools because it's far more rampant there. But it is, you know, it's here and there in the Catholic schools, unfortunately. So my advice is simply just be vigilant and be attentive so that if you see these things cropping up in your Catholic school, either band together with other parents and put a stop to it if that's possible. Now, in the kind of high school that, Anonymous described to me, I would think it would be nigh unto impossible to change the mindset and the ideologies of the people in charge of a school like that. I wouldn't waste, you know, a molecule of energy trying to change the minds of some people like that. Rather, I think the best thing to do is you look for an alternative. So as I know, and I know you know, and you know that I know that you know, that you love your kids with all your heart and you want to do what's right for them. Well, don't forget when it comes to them being in school. I mean, that's a huge block of time every day. What, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, perhaps? Huge block of your child's time that's given over either to authentic learning and growing as a person and socializing and developing skills and sports and talents and all of those things. That's a wonderful and necessary thing for us. And that's great when it's happening that way. But if that huge block of time is given over to, you know, these people, I have certain other words in mind, but I'll leave it that way. These people in charge in these schools who are undermining your child's virtue, they're undermining your parental authority. Hey, don't tell the parents, you know, because they'll never understand what's going on here. So don't tell your parents. Teachers, don't let the parents know. Okay, I mean, that's an immediate red flag. That's the only red flag you need. Why do you need a second or third or fourth red flag? If you find out that the leadership in the school that your kid attends is actively conspiring against you to conceal things from you because they know that you will disapprove of them, then yank your kid out of that school so fast his head will spin. But it's in the middle of the semester. Who cares? Your child's immortal soul could be at stake, huh? So that's my heartfelt advice, and I do agree with Anonymous. There comes a time where you just have to make a drastic step like that when necessary. Hopefully it won't be, but sometimes it is. Let's go to Melissa now in Denver. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. This hopefully is a very easy question for you.
All right.
But why the lamb? Why was Abraham to, you know, they found the ram in the thicket. Mm-hmm. Why the lamb? Did the pagans worship lambs? The Egyptians worship lambs? And so I'm just curious, if the lamb of the sacrifice, why a lamb versus a pigeon versus a goat versus mm-hmm. a whatever?
Okay, that's a fair question. I think ultimately, I don't have the answer for you. I'll give you a few answers that I think do speak to the question. But ultimately, the real question is, why did God arrange things in such a way that the lamb motif is seen over and over again? Ultimately, God alone knows why he did it that way, but we can pick up on some clues. One of the clues, I think, is the meekness of lambs. You know, we think of, I often will remark about children who call in. In fact, the younger the child, the more often I would say, you know, that little lamb asked a beautiful question. And it's not uncommon to think of the innocence and gentleness of children as lamb-like. You know, even Mary had a little lamb, kind of a beautiful little ditty that we all learned in our childhood. So the ultimate answer to the question lies in God's own mind, and I don't know the answer to that. But what I can tell you is that this ram, or the lamb or the sheep image is replete throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. You mentioned a couple of them. Well, another example, of course, would be at the Passover meal in Exodus chapter 12. God commands Moses to have all the families who are about to depart from Egypt, they're going to scram quickly, to serve a meal that they will eat standing up at the table. In the centerpiece of the meal, it has unleavened bread and bitter herbs and all of those things. But the centerpiece of the meal is this lamb, a one-year-old lamb that would be slain, and they would eat it after the blood of this lamb had been sprinkled on the doorposts and lintels of the front door so that the angel of death would pass over that house and not strike down the firstborn. So you know the story. But that is a prefigurement of Jesus. And so throughout the Old Testament, we never see the use of a pig or a horse or any other animal. People can spend time looking at why is it that the pig and other animals, depending on their hooves, cloven or uncloven, were considered unclean and therefore inedible by the Jews. They were not permitted to eat pigs, etc. So for God's own purposes, you never see another example of this that is a direct prefigurement of Jesus. The bulls and the turtle doves and the goats and the other animals that were sacrificed in the temple were, in a broader sense, a more distant sense, they were prefigurements of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. But this lamb-sheep motif is consistent from the Old Testament through the New Testament. This is why, for example, St. John the Baptist, when he first encountered Jesus in the beginning of his public ministry, he cried out, "Behold the Lamb of God, behold him who takes away the sins of the world," because St. John the Baptist was steeped in all of these Old Testament prefigurements. So he knew that Jesus was going to fulfill this image, this motif of the Lamb whose blood is shed, et cetera, throughout the Old Testament. But ultimately, to come back to my answer, I can't tell you why did God do this with this particular animal as opposed to some other animal that we could consider benign. Why not a horse?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why not a, you know, some other, and that I just don't know. I mean, we can see the pattern in Scripture and how it connects to Jesus, but before that, I don't know what to tell you. The meekness of the Lamb, the gentleness, things like that, but so. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I know you asked for an easy, you said it was an easy question, which I think meant you hoped for an easy, simple answer, but I hope I didn't over-answer it for you.
That was good, very, very much. I thought it was maybe that, if you want to say benign, maybe, I don't know the word, because God does things we don't understand, and why a lamb, but it's beautiful because it all ties together. So thank you very
That's
much.
That's true. You're most welcome, Melissa. Thank you for your patience. And as long as we're thinking about that for a moment, I'm thinking about when Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan. And what did God the Holy Spirit choose to manifest his presence? He chose a bird, a dove. Why not a bald eagle with a, you know, 10-foot wingspan? I don't know. Why not a lamb? Well, because that symbolizes Jesus. Why not, you know, something else? Why not a cloud or something else? Why did he choose to manifest himself in the form of a dove? I don't know. Nobody knows for sure. Even the church fathers and others, you know, we offer speculations that would be like, well, the bird is a symbol of freedom and flight and it's heavenly and it's up in the air. And I mean, and those are all true. Those are ways for us to reason our way toward a conclusion by way of analogy or simile, and that's good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But comes a time when we have to say, but ultimately, why did God choose a dove? I don't know. And here we have to just sort of accept our own severe limitations when it comes to our puny human intellects trying to understand the utter vastness, the infinite vastness of God's mind and his knowledge and his choices and his realities. It's so far beyond us. I'll just give you a quick example before we have to take our break, and then I'll come right back to the phone call. So if you're holding, please be patient. I'm coming to you. Story told about St. Augustine that he was pondering the Trinity and this immense, unbelievably lofty reality that God is one God in three persons, and what that means, and how can we understand that even just a little bit. And as the story goes, he's walking along the beach, and he sees a kid who has a hole dug in the sand, and he's watching as the kid sort of walks over to the ocean and gets a bucket of water and then goes back to the hole, pours it in the hole, and he goes back and forth. So Augustine comes up to him, and inquires of the child, well, what are you doing? And he says, well, I'm going to fill up this hole with the ocean. And of course, Augustine laughs and he says, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. You can never fit all that water in that little hole. And then he perceived that this was actually, and the story varies from one to another. Was it Jesus appearing as a little boy or was it an angel? I think the majority view is that Jesus was appearing as a little boy, at least in the story. And he said, you're right, Augustine. I could never fill up this hole with all the water of the ocean, and it would be easier for me to do that than it will be for you to fully comprehend the doctrine of the Trinity. With your puny human intellect, as powerful as his was, ain't no way you're going to be able to fully understand this, but we should make every effort to understand it as best we can. Or as someone once said, a mystery is not something you can know nothing about. A mystery is something you can't know everything about, not till heaven anyway. So we do the best we can in the meantime. I'll be right back.